next 2 years.
Watch what you say.
It's gonna be crazy.
Gonna be off.
Yeah.
Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Thank you for coming in during the interim. We figured we better get some information gathered and do a little thinking about some of these issues before the session starts, because we are going to have a very tight committee schedule during session from a space standpoint as much as anything else, probably mostly that. So I don't expect a lot of informational hearings during session because of that, but we'll have a few in the next month so that we can get information gathered, maybe make some decisions when we come around to the time of the spring. So we're going to talk about funding for community corrections today. I want to welcome Commissioner Roy to the committee and Deputy Commissioner Solheid. So if you two want to start with your presentation, we'll go from there.
Services are delivered within different systems, and it's pretty common occurrence. We have prepared this to give you this presentation, give you a good feel for how correctional community services are delivered in the state of Minnesota. And I would immediately draw, and Mr. Solheid and I will do a joint presentation here. Mr. Chair, I think we can whiz through this presentation fairly efficiently and quickly. You quickly log on questions. You have in the past not any slides, but certainly your call if you want to ask questions for the presentation, or we have other presenters
on the agenda as well. We're going to pause for a second while we get that witness mic set up.
Go to child protection. It's worse in an hour.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Much better.
Could you start over, please? I'm kidding. Go ahead.
We can immediately reference first page, which is a geographic representation of the state of Minnesota, and that basically shows the county structure and the affiliation of those counties with the delivery systems. The white agencies are listed as Community Corrections Act agencies, and those agencies represent most of the main urban areas as well as the significant outlying areas. The DOC and the CPO counties are represented by the darker brown, and the blue counties are counties that the Department of Corrections provides all services for.
So
I know you were going to do this at a high level, but is there some reason why the DOC, CPO counties, looks like the surface of that comet that the...
We were able to get the harpoon to attach, so we're good.
Good, and only two bounces, even better.
But on the next slide, and we can
page
go into
three.
On page three, we can go into a little bit more detail. The Community Corrections Act counties comprise 32 counties in the state, and they are under 17 separate agencies. Some agencies have multiple counties within them, such as Arrowhead Regional Corrections or Tri-County Community Corrections, have multiple counties formed under a joint powers agreement providing services under the Community Corrections Act. The Department of Corrections is in 55 counties of the state, and in 27 of those counties, the Department of Corrections provides felony supervision, and with our county probation officers providing the adult misdemeanor and juvenile supervision in those 27 counties that have the terrain much like the Meteor. The blue counties are the ones where the Department of Corrections provides all of the felony services and through a contract with those counties provides for the agents to provide supervision for the adult misdemeanors and juveniles.
On page four, all agencies that provide correctional services in the communities are represented in this graph, and 109,000 people in this state are currently under probation supervision. And the breakdown between adults and juveniles is the next line down. And an additional 5,400 plus are on supervised release, but the more common description of supervised release that people can relate to is these are parole cases. These are cases that are released from prison. I still like to use the old word parole because everybody knows what that is. In Minnesota, because of the sentencing guidelines, the prison usage is based on criminal history and severity of offense. And in Minnesota, the philosophy is the most serious offenders with the most serious criminal history end up in prison. And you can see almost 10,000 folks are in prison. That sounds like a tremendously high number, but we are the second lowest per capita in the country in terms of our prison population. On page five,
just a little bit more about the terminology. Probation is alternative to confinement, and you need to consider that that's alternative to confinement at the local level for those offenders that are misdemeanant and juvenile offenders typically. Supervised release, again, as the commissioner referenced, is much like parole. Those offenders are released from prison. Intensive supervised release are also offenders released from prison, and I just wanted to point out that they are not included essentially in our other slides here with discussion around funding and how community supervision is funded, because it's kind of a separate type of program that's provided for those high-risk predatory-level offenders. And then, as the commissioner mentioned, parole, which commonly refers to currently are juvenile and life sentence offenders.
On page six, we were requested to provide you, this committee, with some statistics over the course of time. And actually, we had prepared these statistics with our discussion with our community partners. You can see a 10-year history here on page six of the total probation population in the state. 2006, 2007, a really high number of people getting services. Page seven is the adult population related to all probation, a similar trend line. Page eight is the juvenile population, and that particular line is trend over the course of 10 years is very encouraging, from a high of almost 16,000 down to about 7,400. We've been researching this particular decline. It is a nationwide trend. We are very glad that less kids are getting into trouble. The demographics of this age group is declining. There are just fewer kids in the state of Minnesota, fewer kids getting in trouble. We are very hopeful, and I'm going to knock on wood when I say this, that this downward trend in juvenile numbers hopefully someday will transfer into fewer adult prison inmates, knowing that kids that are in trouble early often end up in prison. So this is really good news for the state of Minnesota.
And to what do you attribute the downward trend among adults?
Another great question. And we have asked our research department to explore that as well. And we have not been able to put our finger on any single attribute for that group. We think that there are better interventions in terms of chemical dependency, more attention given to a great example is DWI decline. We, our partners that are sitting here in the room today, our community corrections folks have done a lot of innovative programming at the local level. And we just think it's a lot of good attention to best practices, and you will hear some presentation today about best practices as well. So it's a combination of things, and again, it's a nationwide trend that serious crime is going down in most areas, whether that's a tougher economy, but there are certainly not as much optimism in the adult world as there is in the juvenile world. At page 9, you will see the prison population. And, Mr. Chair, I'm sure you'll be asking what you attribute the growth in prison population to be. And I would attribute that to a complex series of issues. And there are those closely scrutinizing our sentencing guidelines. And the sentencing guidelines are heavily reliant on criminal history. And we know that the more criminal history you accumulate, the more serious your dispositions are, and the longer your prison sentences are. So that, those academics propose that criminal history is something that builds prison population. We also see that there's been enhancements to felony DWI. The drug crimes, the drug sentencing has remained at a very high level. We have very strict supervision of supervised release, post-prison release cases. We have lots of people returning back to prison for violations of their supervised release. Even though we restructure about half of those people, still thousands of people return to prison every year after being released from prison. So it's an accumulation of effect. We're very lucky that that prison growth is much less than many of the other states are experiencing. The southern tier of states are booming in terms of prison population. You have all seen the terrible situation in California where the federal court has had to intervene to reduce prison population. That state is feeling the effects of that. Page 10 is really the meat of this presentation, and Mr. Solheide is going to briefly explain this. It relates to the numbers, and proceed.
All right. So slide 10 talks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, slide 10 talks about how community supervision is funded. And I should point out right out of the gate here, these are state funds that funnel through the DOC to provide funding for community supervision. This does not reflect any county funding, which I'm sure our partners will get into in their presentations.
Well, this is what you refer to as pass-through?
There are three. You can see there are three categories here. The CCA, or Community Corrections Act, funding is pass-through funding that goes to those 17 agencies, the 32 counties. This is the state contribution to community supervision in those counties. So as you can see, the subsidy is $38 million. There are three additional lines under there. There were subsequent funds or pools of funding provided for community supervision for specific categories. Adult felony supervision, these were serious felony offenders, where additional funding in past years was increased to provide additional support for those activities for community supervision, primarily additional FTEs, additional agents to provide that supervision. Caseload workload reduction funding came through and I think about 1995 and then again at a later date. This was to provide additional funding because caseloads were extremely high for agents and workloads had increased. And it's not just the numbers on supervision, but also the work that the agents were doing with these offenders. And then the adult felony sex offender supervision funds were added. So the total funding coming through to the CCA counties, the state pass-through monies, is $55,586,000. This is an annual. This is the 2014 budget, so this is an annual amount. The county probation offices, and again, those are those county probation offices in the 27 counties where they are providing for the misdemeanant, adult misdemeanant and juvenile supervision. It's a different funding mechanism. Essentially, these are all legislative appropriations, but with the CPO counties, it's a reimbursement formula. And so those counties that are providing the agents to provide supervision to that segment of the population on supervision are reimbursed a portion of that salary and fringe for those agents that are providing that supervision. They also received some caseload workload reduction dollars when those monies came through. So you can see that the appropriation is currently a little over $6.5 million for that purpose. And then the next category shows the Department of Corrections.
I'm sorry, let me interrupt you, Commissioner.
Right ahead.
When you have the caseload workload reduction line, is there any specific restriction on how that money is used different from the money that's coming through on the reimbursement line or some other line?
Those are attributed to agent positions in those agencies, and they report on those each year in their budgets, the positions that are funded or the activities that are funded with those dollars. So those are reported on separately within their budgets.
All right, currently. Thank you.
Then the Department of Corrections funding category here shows that there is just a little over $17 million that goes toward our probation and supervised release. So in essence, our DOC field services unit. This provides for our operations in those 55 counties where we're providing for felony supervision in all 55 counties and in those counties where we are also providing supervision to adult misdemeanants and juveniles on contract with the 28 counties that contract with the department to provide for those supervision services.
Mr. Chair, those counties typically contract with us because they may lack the capacity or the infrastructure to provide correctional services, and in terms of training, administration, and the efficiency of operations, so they have chosen to negotiate that relationship with us.
And these are typically, if you look at the map, you'll see many of these are smaller rural counties, smaller population. And there's some efficiency of scale with the Department of Corrections providing that in multiple small rural counties versus having to do them individually with their own departments. Just the footnote on here, too, this does not include the supervision funding for intensive supervised release or challenge incarceration, and I just wanted to make that note again. The next slide, you can see again, is just
page 11,
a graph over time of these funds and how they have increased and decreased over approximately a 10-year period. Again, noting that this is just an annual budget. So each year you can see how the funding for, on the top line, that is the Community Corrections Act pass-through funding. The next line is the DOC field services funding. And then the bottom line is the county probation office funding, that is reimbursement funding to those agencies. This, and I would note that this is the aggregate amount. This is the total amount, including the caseload, workload, sex offender supervision, and all categories of funds that are passed through.
So I'm noting that the DOC line seems to reflect over this 10-year trend period a more substantial increase than the other lines, if you look from the beginning to the end. What would you attribute that?
Mr. Chair, the
Commissioner Roy.
Members, the appropriation for the Department of Corrections comes through this legislative process. Over the years, there has been years of good support for our community partners, and other years that support has not been as generous. And that's the reality of this funding stream. We'll talk in a bit about how this is calculated, but certainly we will definitely not sit here today and not recognize that.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This doesn't include any county funding, so this is just state funding on this particular chart. And do we have a look at what the county funding has done?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin,
I believe
our county partners will provide that, both CCA and CPO. You are correct that this is clearly just state funding, and I would note that when you look at the graph, certainly the state contribution here to the CCA funding is a small portion of their budget or a portion of their budgets, overall budgets, and the same with the county probation offices. With regard to the DOC, that is our entire budget for field services operations.
May I ask a question?
Senator Sherman.
I just want to stay on this because I'm aware that if I'm getting the terminology correct, I have to go back to your definitions. The community corrections, CCAs, that's the red, correct?
Correct.
And so I would be very interested in understanding when the legislature does distribute money for these community supervision. It's a block of money. We don't define that it goes to one or the other of these programs. Is that correct? So that's a decision that's made based on the five factors that we're moving to next. And I know there's some issues about this, about whether or not this distribution is really appropriately placed between these three different systems for providing community supervision. So are you aware of that there is a debate among the contract holders here about how you are distributing these resources between the programs?
Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Roy.
Senator Sharon, we are so familiar with that issue. It has been on our plate, and these folks are my friends and colleagues, and we have had numerous discussions about that issue.
And can you,
because
they'll come up and give us our perspective, but can you articulate your justification for how you are distributing those resources at this point so that this is the trend line?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we justify it based on the appropriation that we are given for that purpose. And in consideration of our total budget. Since I have been commissioner, I have been an advocate for increases to that particular line, and it has varied in level of support for that increase by not only the legislature It has to go through the entire vetting process that I know you are very familiar with.
Senator Sherman.
Maybe I'm not as familiar as you think I am. Senator Latz or someone. Do we make a line item appropriation specifically for community supervision? Or is there money, a general appropriation made to the Department of Corrections, and then it is distributed to the various items?
Mr. Turner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sherman, we make a single appropriation to community services, and that is represents their base budget, and then we have change items which are added to the base budget, and one of the change items, for example, 2 years ago, two of the change items was there's an increase in county probation reimbursement, and another one was increase in the CCA subsidy. So it's the legislature that makes the decision on how much the counties get. And I guess one of the things, the frustration of the counties is they feel like they have to come back and lobby the legislature for increases. But that is also true of everybody else, you know. But no, it's the legislature that makes the decision, and it is a line item on the, you know, a line item with a rider in the bill.
Thank you.
So,
Commissioner Solheid.
Mr. Chair, slide number 12. Just quickly, the Community Corrections Act funding formula under Minnesota Statute 401. And again, just reiterating, there's 17 CCA agencies with 32 counties. Just at a high level, how the funds are distributed is much more complex than what is just here, but this is just the basics of the CCA formula. There are five factors that go into the CCA formula, and this is contained in statute, which determines essentially how those funds are distributed within those 32 counties. The CPO reimbursement on slide 13 is under 244.19, and this is the 27 counties providing juvenile and adult misdemeanor probation services. This is reimbursement funding, and it's funds that are appropriated, as Mr. Turner mentioned, through the legislative process. And the funds that are appropriated are then distributed based upon the number of approved positions that each of these counties have in that funding pool. The statute does indicate that up to 50% of the total costs for the salary and fringe for the agents in that pool are provided. However, if the appropriation is insufficient to provide for 50%, it is prorated. And as you can see, reimbursement was 50% in 1996, and since that time it is consistently diminished down to where it is now 30.5% of the salary and fringe is reimbursed to these counties. DOC field services funding is on slide 14. And I would note that DOC field services funding, that $17 million, is essentially about 3.6% of the total agency budget, which includes our facilities, operations support, and the community services division. Field services is a part of that community services division. I won't go into the next bullet points because I think we've already covered those. Slide 15 gives you, in essence, what the department's biennial budget is overall. You can see our 14-15 biennial budget included $226,432,000 for community services, which is community services overall is 23% of our agency's budget. On slide 16, we can get into a little bit more of the detail, about as much as I think we need to get into here, hopefully. And you can see how the community services budget, this is the biennial budget, essentially plays out. 59% of the community services budget is pass-through monies to counties. That includes the CCA and CPO funding. You can look, there are other units within community services that provide services to to the community, essentially our hearings and release unit, sentencing to service, special supervision, that's our ISR and CIP supervision, which I said we were keeping those dollars out of this. So when you look down, you can see that probation and supervised release is about a 19% budget item in our total community services budget. And again, as I said, field services is 19% of community services. Community services is 23% of the agency budget. And the field services unit, our probation and supervised release portion of this, is about 3.6% of the overall agency budget.
Mr. Chair, this is the conclusion of our presentation, other than, again, emphasizing our mission. We will entertain questions now or later.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? No. Senator Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was wondering, what effect has the increase in people and juveniles with mental illness had on the budget, in both the community corrections budget and the state budget? Can you give me an idea?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodman, we have a strong feeling that significant mental illness exists in our juvenile client pool. There's no question about it. To quantify the budget impact would be very difficult. I would say, however, that our Red Wing facility, which is the most serious juvenile offenders some of the most serious offenders in the state, lots of those kids have lots of diagnoses and dual dependencies and a boatload of issues. And I'm glad you brought that up, because not only in the juvenile world, but also in the adult world, we are just seeing a tremendous impact of mental illness.
Senator Goodman.
Thank you. On that same issue, I toured Stillwater recently, and I was told that 70% of the women in Stillwater have a diagnosis or a known mental illness. And in the work group I've been in, sheriffs and so forth from all over the state are telling me up to 50% of their population has a mental illness because of the lack of services, of mental health services. They see the costs and the increasing, and they see that people that are diagnosed or get a diagnosis when they're in jail are much more expensive than a regular incarcerated person, because of not only because of medication, because of the physician services or whatever that are needed, and because they stay in longer and they're much more likely to have repeat small offenses, but repeat offenses over and over again. So I don't know if there's any way to calculate that excess cost or whatever, but as some states are turning to adding a lot more mental health services, they are finding huge savings in their correction system. Florida's an example. I went down there and looked at their facility, and they are realizing $20 to $50 million savings, and that's only in the jail part. That's not even in the emergency room part. So if there's some way we can take a look at that in the future, at the cost, the additional cost, then we would know what kind of savings we could get to develop other services.
Senator Sharon.
I wonder, do you do any kind of review or analysis of the history of the people that are in this, either the community supervision system or in any of the prison systems, to determine if they have a history of family systems being reported for family assessment for neglect or for child protection services? Are you tracking that at all in your population?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have some analyses of select groups that have been analyzed for that kind of family trauma, but I couldn't with any great confidence tell you that we have been able to do a system-wide analysis of that. We do intake interviews with every inmate about existing mental illness. We can quantify in terms of the dollars spent, in terms of what we provide for adult or behavioral health staff. And the county jails and our county partners certainly do a lot of work in the community with that, at that level. So it, and the county jails that you suggest also do have probably far more intake of those kind of street level mental illness cases that we don't necessarily see in prison. But I would say that so many of our inmates present themselves in a way that we might think they have no mental illness, but I would suggest that to be involved in criminal activity consistently over many years is in itself a mental illness.
Thank you. And, Senator, I'm certain of that. But I'm also, we are also looking at our child protection system at the same time in another vein, not related, not, and that's not what we're here about today, but the issue that relates to this and why I'm asking the question about data is that our failure to invest in the child protection system early on and to effectively intervene in families leaves children in an environment that predictably will create the problems that we're trying to manage later. So I just thought maybe you had a system of analyzing what are the drivers of this system in the first place. So thank you.
Put your crack research staff on that.
Mr. Chair, we certainly have anecdotal stories, and many of these folks have been juvenile probation officers in their previous life, as I was. And walking into some of those homes, it was clear what the issue was. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Joshua Milo, come on up. Did anyone else want to get a tag team as well? Whoever else was going to come up together or you alone, that's fine.
I think they're leaving me solo today.
Okay, introduce yourself for the record, please, and go ahead with your presentation.
Hey, Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Josh Milo with Blue Earth County Community Corrections and representing the Minnesota Association of Community Correction at Counties.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today what we'll talk about is with CCA and who we are. You have heard CCA provides the full range of probation and supervised release or parole services of all offense levels in 32, soon to be 33 counties. Of July 1st of 2015, we'll be adding Sherburne County as a CCA county as well. Some of the themes we'll be talking about today is community supervision and how counties specifically are significantly underfunded, how we've moved away from incentives for counties to choose CCA, how the funding process is not transparent. There's many funding streams, different formulas, or no formulas at all. Also, what we was alluded to in the last testimony is that the counties, we really have no seat at the table. We rely on the Department of Corrections to really make our pitch for funding through the governor's budget and through conversations we have with the commissioner. Although we feel we have a very good relationship with the commissioner, he's going off what he does with the Department of Corrections, which kind of leaves us out in the dark, and we have to be very reactionary once that budget is released. And also we'll talk about some of the potential solutions we see in this. Talking about the principles of the CCA, or the Community Corrections Act, which was started in 1973, the explicit intention of the Act was to decentralize responsibility for the delivery of correctional services by shifting the focus from the state to the local county level. Providing services locally at the county level was seen as the preferred method of supervision, and this is the method that is employed both by Community Corrections Act counties and our partners with the County Probation Officer System, also known as the CPO counties. There's a subsidy which provided a financial motivator to incentivize for supervising the non-dangerous offenders at the local level, and that's an issue where that subsidy has no more really become an incentive for the counties to provide the service. And we look at this as not the typical unfunded mandate that we talk about. We choose to provide these services. It's a partnership we felt we've had with the state. But what's different is although we have this partnership and it's something we choose to do, the funding has not kept up to let us provide to do the services that we've been able to do in the past. So talking about criminal justice funding and really looking back to about fiscal year 2002 is within the criminal justice system, it's to us very evident our partners have fared far better than community services, and that's included as DOC community services as well. DOC facilities in this time frame have increased their investments 56%. District courts have more than doubled their funding. Public defenders have increased their funding 45%, and in the same time frame, the DOC community services, which include those pass-through funds, is a 5% increase. And within those numbers, it's even much bleaker for the counties. Looking at that time frame from 2002 is our CPO partners have increased their funding 1.4%, CCA counties 8.2%, and the DOC field services 33%. So a very significant variation of the amount of funding over those last 12 years. So looking at what is the need for the resources and why what we're talking about, why is this problematic for us? Like all employee-intensive areas of government, our costs have risen dramatically. It's based on employees. Look for us in Blue Earth County, if we look over our last 10 years, although we have one more employee than we had 10 years ago, our county funding to supervise and to fund our agency has tripled. We've gone from about a $400,000 levy contribution in Blue Earth County in 2004 to about a $1.2 million levy contribution in 2014. So it's pretty significant what we are putting into this to fund community corrections within Blue Earth County. In some agencies over this time frame.
Mr. Amato, let me ask you. Quick question. You said you had one FTE increase, but the funding has increased a lot more than that?
Significantly. And a big part is looking at what just our increase in cost for salary and benefits. And the benefits is really significant going over these last 10 years of how much we're putting into health insurance and those fringe benefits. And over that time, based on union negotiated wages between the county and our unions, there has been pay increases, which approximately around 2% over those last 10 years. So each of those positions that we have are significantly costlier than what they were back in 2004. And so with that is, although looking at us, we're about the same, we're almost stagnant, which many of our CCA counties are. There are some counties, and one that we look at is Hennepin County. Hennepin County has actually reduced their FTEs by 5% over the last 10 years to supervise individuals within Hennepin County. What we have learned and why we need the resources is that protecting the public is accomplished by providing progressive, effective correctional practices that research has shown to reduce recidivism. The field has changed. There was a time that probation and supervision was more condition-based. We got conditions from the court. We did that. Now it's changed where it's about risk assessment, need assessment, really giving thorough interventions, taking on the needs of the offender. So that part of our system has really changed. So looking at that is we're not just looking at resources, but also reform. When we look at the system now, there's multitude of funding streams that make funding decisions difficult to the legislature. I think what we even heard in the last testimony, looking at the funding, it's difficult to see where the money is going, how it gets there, how it's asked for. So that creates some complications. Looking at it also is the counties have been disproportionately impacted by the lack of resources for community supervision. Also touched on earlier is counties don't have a voice in the budget process prior to the legislative consideration. We talked a couple years ago there was an increase in the CCA funding. That happened after the governor's budget came out and there was no money for CCA. What we did as MACAC is we went and searched out authors to look at increasing that funding through CCA. And that was more difficult because that was after the session started. We scrambled. We were successful with some funding, but it would have been a lot easier having a voice earlier in the process as that budget was developed to see how we could have more equity in this funding system. And also,
Milo, are you not allowed to communicate directly with the governor's office?
What we have always relied on through Community Corrections Act counties is that we have relied on the Commissioner of Corrections and Department of Corrections to be that link between us and the governor's office. Definitely, would we like a way or a mechanism that we would have more of a direct line with the governor's office in the budgeting process? That's one of the things we could look at and aiming for with reform.
Well, part of my question is, I understand that's been the practice, is to work through the commissioner, but is there anything that is specifically prohibiting you from having direct communication with the governor's office?
Not that we've seen, and that there's something prohibiting us statutorily. It's just been more the practice that we've gone through with the Department of Corrections. The other thing is we look at counties that are looking at delivery system changes, whether it's going to CCA or going to CPO, as there's a lack of transparency on if they change to a different delivery system, what would the funding even look like? They have to get very far down the process to make that determination what funding would be for their county. Next, we'll talk a little bit about the funding flowchart. And when we looked at that and talked about earlier, is there's the six major pots of money funding field services. There's at least one specific pot for each delivery system, one for DOC, one for CPO, one for CCA. And then there's three other pots that are shared sometimes by two of the delivery systems, or sometimes they are shared by all three of the delivery systems. And that is a mechanism, whether these different pots shifting around, is who's going to get what if one of those pots of money is funded. So the complexity makes it very difficult for the legislature to determine if they are fully funding community supervision or if the three delivery systems are funded equitably. What we have said in the past is we feel that the funding process is broken. We're not saying that the delivery system process is broken, as feel that is a right and a choice of the counties to make which funding level they would like, but the funding process is broken. And one of the big reasons we say the funding level is broken is if you looked at the chart we had just a couple of moments ago, is over the last 10 years, if we had a working formula, we would not have these type of disparities. We wouldn't have over 10 years one system receiving a 33% increase, one a little over 8%, and one around 2%. That wouldn't happen in a fully functioning funding system. So what we look at with goals of reform and how we would solve this is we'd simplify the funding of all probation for all delivery systems. We'd provide a mechanism for all delivery systems to be treated equitably when funding does increase, distribute state funding for probation services based on needs, and provide a stronger voice for the counties within that budgeting process, and offer counties clarity in determining financial support in any three of the delivery systems that they would choose to participate in. We'll talk briefly a little bit about a single funding.
Oh, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have on that one issue, the distribute state funding for probation services based on needs, the chart that we just saw from the Department of Corrections, it appears that that is what's happening.
For Community Corrections Act counties, it is based on need. But for some, for like the CPO system is a reimbursement model where there's not a formula to distribute the funding to the county and probation officer systems. And I don't want to speak for the Department of Corrections, but I don't believe technically there's a formula for the Department of Corrections on how they distribute for their community services funds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator.
Go ahead.
All right. So talking about single funding, this was discussed last session. We brought forward a proposal that met our goals.
Sorry,
that we
had. I want to back you up because I had a question, too. For the last 10 or 15 years, at least as long as I've been in the legislature, the budgets have been very, very tight, and there's been a consistent shift, where possible, from state funding or state subsidies to local governments to put more responsibility financially on local governments. It happened in LGA. It's happened in all sorts of different parts of the budget. And it looks like that's happened in this part of the budget, too. Do you think that there's anything more going on here to account for the differentials that you're seeing in the community corrections funding than sort of the general trend of trying to push off state obligations onto local governments?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't see anything else different. It's just we've had very tight budget times, and the expectation was put down to the counties that if you want these probation services, it's something we're going to have to fund. And that's something the counties have been doing. And over the last 10 years, we look at 2004, the county contribution for all of probation services was $137.5 million. In 2014, the county contribution has raised to $192.8 million. So if you look over that point of time of 10 years, that is a very significant increase, going from 137 to 192 of just the county contributions alone.
Senator Sharon.
I want you to answer that question again, because your answer confuses me. On the one hand, you're showing us on page 5 this slide that shows the differential between the funding increases between these three programs that provide services in different methods. And yet you're saying that you think what's driving this differential is the fact that the state is withdrawing more and more of its support for these services and causing counties to have to pay more for it? I mean, that I don't understand how the state's withdrawal from LGA or from anything would cause this big a differential in how the dollars that you do have for community services, no matter what the methodology is, to cause this differential to occur and how what money you do have is distributed.
Chair, Senator Sharon, try to answer that. Is when we look over these last 10 years and we look at that number, so we saw that a little over 8% in the state contributions. So we look at over 10 years, if there's 8%, that is a very small amount of the money that would have been necessary to run community corrections or other CPO agencies over that point of time. So there was really decisions that counties had to make. Is we could have said, you know, we're going to operate our corrections budgets just what we have from our state funding. We're not going to put any more as a county. But then as a county, we'd also be looking at what would we sacrifice for public safety in those counties. So, yeah, we could have just not raised any more money, but we put that money in on the county side to maintain our level of services. And it's really about maintaining. As we're seeing across the board, we're not seeing significant increases in staffing. This is just our existing staffing.
I'm not being clear. You're talking about the increase that the counties had to contribute in order to continue to maintain a certain reasonable risk level for safety purposes. I'm talking about your slide, the slide here on page 5, which is the one that's on your chart. It shows this is the percentage of funding increases. This is legislative funding.
State funding for the counties.
State funding, yeah, that's distributed to the counties. Correct. And there's a substantial difference between the increases from the DOC and the CPO. So I'm asking you to explain why you think with the money that you do get from the state, we're seeing that differential in increases between these three programs. Okay.
I'll defer to Mr. Erdman, our director of MACAC.
Mr. Chair, my name is Ryan Erdman. I'm the executive director for MACAC. And I think, Senator Sharon, the way I would answer the question is, in the third column, in the DOC column, that is support for services that are provided in counties but provided by the state. So as investments have been made, they've been made in the state delivery system. But in the counties, the decision has been made, since the county is there as a backup, we'll have minimal investment in those delivery systems on the state level and let the counties fill in the gap to make sure that adequate services are provided. So because, and in some cases, the state provides the service, they have seen that increase from the state. So the investment has been in the state-provided services and the county-provided services. There's been the minimal investment, and that has, like I said, been backfilled by counties. That's the differentiation that chart represents, I think, is how I would describe that.
Well, Senator, that's why I was asking this question about how is this decision made. May I also ask you to go back then to the funding flow chart where you're talking about the state of Minnesota funding, and then it's distributed between these programs, and then this is the actual rate of increase. That decision about money going from the state to DOC, CCA, or CPO, is that made by the Department of Corrections, and you don't have a voice in that? Or is that made by funding line items that the legislature puts in the budget? Are we making this decision that causes this outcome? with the money that we have? Is it being distributed? Or is money going to the Department of Corrections and through the Department of Corrections, the decision is to put more money into DOC and less into these other areas because they can count on the counties to cover the gap?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, it is the latter. That is a decision made by the legislature in terms of how those funds are allocated. And this gets to the question, though, Chair Latz asked regarding can we work with the governor's office directly. Certainly we can. We can advocate for them. What we can't do is submit our own change item. We can't come up with a decision ourselves as counties and say, yep, we're going to go to MMB. We're going to go through the process. We're going to submit a change item that asks for this increase. We are unable to do that. Only the DOC can submit that change item. So we can work with them. We can contact the governor's office and advocate and hope that that change item is submitted, but we cannot do that ourselves. And so at that point, we are then are at the mercy of the DOC and the governor's office to decide what change item is presented to you. What happened last time, there was no change item for county pass-throughs. There was only an increase for DOC agents. We came through then. Chair Latz was our key advocate when we got to conference committee by far, and we submitted our own piece of legislation, but we were in that stage of the game. We're in the legislative stage of the game where we had a standalone bill that we brought forth that was separate and was not represented in the governor's budget. And again, we couldn't have submitted that change item for consideration to the governor. We could have called them and talked to them and said, please do it. But
okay, but let me just hammer in on this. I have to go to a Child Protection Task Force, so I'm sorry to, but this is, I'm just trying to get this clear in my mind. Because then as it's in the governor's budget, that the governor may determine with some guidance from some place how to distribute this money between these three programs. So there's guidance coming from someplace to the governor's office for that. And so that I'm curious to know where the guidance comes from. And if the decision-making at that point that gives preferential treatment to DOC here, there has to be something there that is giving preferential treatment to DOC over these others. I just do not understand how that could not be the case, because what you're saying is that the governor is making a budget, but all the departments put forward their recommendations for the budget and for the line items, so that's got to be a part of the process. So somewhere at some level that I couldn't quite figure out before, the Department of Corrections is submitting what it thinks the distribution should be. It's being built into the budget. And what I hear these folks saying is that if that decision is made to give DOC's programs the priority, there's not a channel through which this group on the front end has a chance to make a case for a change in what that recommendation is. Am I getting the picture correct, Senator Latz?
Okay. I think you are.
Thank you. That's it. That's all I need to know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Sherman.
All right,
moving on to a single funding proposal that was brought last session. Really what this was brought was it was using a single needs-based formula, and we were preferential to the CCA formula as that is a needs-based formula that takes into account the actual crimes that are committed and looking at the population and looking at net tax capacity as well. And what the bill did is establish a current funding in each county as a base with new money going through the formula. So the goal is that no one would be hurt at the time of utilizing that for all of the delivery systems. But going forward, if there was new money that was allocated, then that money would go through the new formula, which would be needs-based for all of the delivery systems. At this time, the secondary formula would not be developed, which would need to be done if this was going to be happen and workable, because the counties that have both DOC and CPO in them would have to have a secondary formula on how they would separate those funds within that county. If that could be done, it would be a fully developed proposal. With that, we felt all counties in the DOC would benefit from increased state appropriations, and that's the goal, that all three delivery systems would win under that scenario when there is increased funding. It also allowed the legislature a single line item to fund all field supervision in Minnesota. There wouldn't have to be a choice of six different pots to fund during the budgeting process. That was single funding. There's other options also as reform that it doesn't get to all of the things we outline, which we would like to see in reform, but there are some changes that would get to some of the goals. And some of those would be looking at linking to the Department of Corrections increases. So we could keep separate pots of money for each of the delivery systems and then add statutory language that the county pass-through funds must increase at the same level of DOC field services appropriations. Could also look at combining categorical funds into a primary funding streams. It brings the system back to a one-pot per delivery system, and it simplifies that funding chart where there'd just be three funding charts instead of six different funding charts. And also looking at a separate line item for pass-through funding, this would make it clear that county pass-through funding is or is not increasing. At this point in time, if looking at it, and if it increases, it may look like, yes, community corrections funding is increasing in our state, but it may only be increasing for one delivery system, not for all of those. And so it would bring that transparency if there was that separate line item to say what is each delivery system getting through the process. And so in closing, then, unlike the single funding proposal, those are different options. But you know, really why we went with the single funding proposal, we felt it took up all of those goals of reform for more transparency and equitable funding for the corrections delivery systems.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Marlowe. Any questions from members of the committee? All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators.
I have Mike McMillan and John Clavens from the CPO counties. Come on forward. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and state your name for the record.
Mike McMillan, Director of Wright County Court Services.
Good morning. John Clavens, Director of Carver County Court Services in Chaska.
Mr. Chair and committee, we hopefully received our presentation that we're going to go through today, talk a little bit about the CPO system of corrections delivery in our state, and we'll touch briefly on funding. I don't think we'll focus a majority of our time on funding as it's an ongoing topic, but we will address it and give you some of the concerns we have from the county probation officer side, if that's okay.
Yes, thank you, members. The presentation is in your packets.
A little bit about county probation services and where we sit in the picture of criminal justice. There's 27 CPO counties in the state. We feel that there clearly is a local choice when our counties choose to be part of the county probation system, and there's clearly checks and balances between county courts and the state of Minnesota, and we feel we have a real positive relationship with all the entities. Clearly, there's a changing landscape in criminal justice today, and we feel our system's been able to adjust, reallocate services to meet community and county needs as well as the court's needs. And we are going to talk a little bit about evidence-based practices and how we've put that into play to meet the local needs of our communities. In the presentation, like I mentioned already, the 27 counties, we'll talk a little bit more about county courts, legislature, and DOC and how we all work together, delivery of service, evidence-based practices, and, of course, to finish up with, again, as I said before, a brief discussion about the dollars and how they're allocated currently and maybe some of the things that we've seen for the reasons of the reduction in our allocation over a period of time. Like the commissioner talked about, law enforcement, I thought that was a pretty good segue into criminal justice and county and probation in our state. Again, we have 27 counties, and again, we feel there clearly is a local choice, and sometimes that gets a little confusing, I understand, to legislatures, and sometimes I've heard to county boards, but at least the county boards that I'm associated with, they're not very confused. They understand clearly the delineation and how the relationship works with the courts and the Department of Corrections. CPO counties clearly work with the county boards. The county boards control our budget. They must approve all positions. And our employees are actually county employees for benefits, FMLA, and those types of things that you may be familiar with. The courts do, though, hire, fire, and supervise our probation agents. And in most counties, there's a director, if not all, that does that supervision for the court. Currently, our agents are paid on a state scale. up to 50% reimbursement. And that gets a little bit touchy because right now it's sitting at about 30% reimbursement. But statutorily, it defines 50%, and we'll get into that at the end of the presentation. Now, probation officers supervise the offenders in split between court services and DOC. And what that means for you is if there's a felony offender in the county that I work in, as an example, that felony offender, after conviction, is supervised by the Department of Corrections. Prior to conviction, and you'll see a list of some of the services that we provide, at least in our county and most of the CPO counties, we're providing pretrial services even for felony offenders. But there's a cooperative effort with the DOC and the counties that we represent. And then local correctional facilities are operated by the county. So in our county, as an example, the county sheriff operates the jail. And we have a cooperative effort on a juvenile facility with a number of other counties on a joint powers agreement. So probation services, the objective at least of the services we provide are to deter, punish, reparate, and rehabilitate our community. And, of course, under the framework of public safety. There's a sheet in your handout that talks about probation services. On the left hand, it's titled probation services in the top right-hand corner where we didn't number ours. On the left-hand side of that sheet, you'll see statutory services that we're expected to provide by statute. On the right-hand side of the sheet are services we provide within county probation services that necessarily others are not statutory. So as the landscape has changed, and you've seen the numbers dropped in some of the slides from the Department of Corrections and I believe from the CCA presentation, that doesn't mean that necessarily the numbers of offenders that we're dealing with have changed. That means the probation numbers, according to our reporting system, have somewhat decreased, especially on the supervision side. But what we're finding is, at least on the agencies that we represent, there's been a shift. And a lot of that shift has come at the lower level and at the beginning of the stages of somebody coming into the criminal justice system. So as an example, pretrial services has increased dramatically. And those numbers have been somewhat hard to quantify, but I know the Department of Corrections is working on those now as we move into discussion about future funding. Pre-sentence investigations and assessment of risk and some of the stuff that Mr. Clavens will talk about as far as evidence-based practices changed the work of probation officers across the state. We're doing alcohol and drug testing. You know, I'm on the Senator's committee, Goodwin's committee on offenders with mental illness. You know, and she brought up the fact about juveniles and what are we doing for juveniles. Well, one of the things that we're doing for juveniles in this state right now, and we have been for a number of years, is mental health assessments. And most of that work is being done at our level, pretrial, on the juvenile side in the criminal justice system. So I think we've made some inroads, especially on juveniles. I think probably on adults we have a lot more work to do, at least that's what I'm hearing within the committee structure, but that is something that is being done. So those are the reallocation of services that we're providing. And we're also involved with specialty courts and continued collaboration at the local levels with schools and other areas in our communities. And really a framework for that is the use of evidence-based practices. And Mr. Clavens has been a leader in our state in evidence-based practice, so I'm going to turn it over to him to talk about how services have tied into evidence-based practices.
Thank you, Mr. Clavens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I really feel strongly that no funding discussion can occur here without some reference to evidence-based practices, as Mr. McMillan and others before me have mentioned. The field of corrections, really since the mid-1990s, has made some tremendous strides in looking at evidence-based practices, or what we may call what works, what the science of corrections looks like in probation. In your slide, I've got a couple of examples of some of the larger categories that we've studied, looked at, and tried to implement over the course of the last 15 or 20 years. Providing effective supervision to offenders in our communities, which involves considering the risk levels of the people that we work with, what the needs are as far as changing their behavior, the appropriate responses, and also looking at our community resources. And at the local county level, we work very closely with our communities and our providers and our partners really in the community, those that provide programs that we can't necessarily afford to provide on our own. Probation officers, I think, really across all three delivery systems utilize strategies and approaches and programs that focus on enhancing public safety and really looking at reducing the risk levels of the clients that we work with. Measuring outcomes and results that are achieved, and not only measuring the outcomes, but making decisions based on those outcomes. So if we have programs that are not working, we make some shifts or changes and utilize the resources that we get, both local and state, in an appropriate fashion and in a responsible, cost-effective manner. And really, the principles of EVP, which are outlined on the next slide that you'll have in your packet, are national principles. These aren't things that we came up with in the county probation world or even locally. These were established some years back through some national research and actually international research across the field of corrections and probation. Those principles include assessing the risk and needs of the offenders we work with. 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we didn't necessarily assess risk except based on the offense level of the client. Well, now we know in the research that there's a number of other factors that we have to look at. Pro-social attitudes or antisocial attitudes, depending on the offender's background, family history, alcohol, drugs, chemicals. There are a number of important factors that we look at to assess the level of risk that our offenders pose in our local counties. Enhancing intrinsic motivation. We have training for almost every probation officer probably in the state related to motivational interviewing, which is, again, a research-based approach in working with people to develop rapport and helping them change their behavior. It also means holding them accountable, but helping them to internalize the changes that are needed. We target interventions, programs specifically toward the risk areas, the risk needs of the clients that we have. A lot of our staff now are also being trained in directed practice, such as cognitive behavioral interventions. Some years ago, we wouldn't have seen that. And that requires a lot of work. Our staff have to be trained in programs. They run group programs directly with clients in many of our counties. And additional resources would certainly help us to enhance those approaches and those research-based programs in reducing the risk levels of the clients that we work with. Other areas include increasing positive reinforcement, engaging our ongoing communities to support the folks coming back out of the institutions in particular. Offender reentry is a big portion of that. I know the local Department of Corrections here has had lots of grants and things that they're working on to help reestablish reentry as a priority in our business. And again, measuring outcomes and providing measurement feedback. By example, we've had what's called the Evidence-Based Practices Policy Team. It's been established since 2004, and all three delivery systems have really worked very collaboratively to look at what works, what we need to implement, and also talk about the additional resources that we need if we really want to try to establish a very consistent and very thorough process related to evidence-based practices and what we offer for our clients. So EVP on the next slide really talks about knowing what works and also what does not work. Interviewing skills, what we call effective alliance, which is a new approach that we're looking at developing some training on, where we work closely with our clients and with our partners, using risk assessments that are research-based, case planning, and targeted interventions. We've put some major efforts forth in resources trying to develop a case planning curriculum here in Minnesota and training all of our probation officers in those areas. And as I mentioned earlier, cognitive behavioral approaches, reentry, and community support. We also have some efforts going on reaching out to local universities and colleges. Our belief is if we can get criminal justice students trained in some of these approaches early on, that provides, again, a good use of resources when we hire people into the business who have the right mindset and the right background in the work that we do.
Excuse me, Mr. Clavin. Senator Goodwin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clavin, do you have CIT training, anger management training?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we certainly do have those types of programs. We have different programs that deal with anger management. We have one of the national programs that we utilize is called Thinking for a Change. It involves problem-solving skills, emotions management, assertiveness, communication skills, all those kind of things to help change behavior. And it's a very proactive approach in trying to help someone develop skills. So when they leave our system, they have a better life and hopefully don't come back into the probation system or worse yet end up in the prison system. So a lot of the work we do is really proactive and early intervention types of things.
Thank you.
So getting to the next slide we have is the partnership slide. Really, from our vision, everyone has a responsibility. The state, the legislature, obviously, the Department of Corrections, who works closely with us in many different ways, the courts, the counties, local communities. Some of those responsibilities, obviously, through the legislative process include adequate financial support for our probation services across the state, including county services. appropriate statutory foundations and looking at what is required, laws and mandated responsibilities. In addition to that, we look at the DOC as being fiscally responsible for their pass-through dollars, so that we get adequate funding. Mr. McMillan had referenced the statute, the 244.19, our 50% reimbursement statute. That's just for our salaries of our appointed staff. But those dollars are critical for us to keep our programs and our services running. Monitoring compliance with state guidelines and mandates. We look to the DOC also for leadership and correctional philosophy and best practices, and work again collaboratively with all three delivery systems. And management of state correctional institutions obviously comes with the Department of Corrections. But we work in partnership with counties and all the delivery systems together. The courts are, of course, our partner, and in the CPO world, they're a very critical component because we do have to get their approval to hire any new positions, and oftentimes they get very involved in the programming that we establish locally. So we expect, again, there's fair and timely justice and insurance of public safety and accountability and compliance with the court orders. Our counties, as Mr. McMillan referenced, our county boards really do control our budgets. They establish our budgets up front. We provide the services, and we then seek our reimbursement the next year after the services are completed, and that's related to the 50% statute, along with the caseload workload dollars that we get individually in our departments. So the counties have fiscal responsibility for the local levy dollars. We will have a few examples here at the end of how that might look in an individual county. The biggest investment in public safety, because offenders live in the local community. So the folks that we service obviously live in our counties, and the county boards recognize that, and to ensure that local community needs are being met. We also look to our citizens to make sure that they know that the tax dollars are getting utilized appropriately, and keeping our communities involved in strategic planning, speaking out about safety issues, and ensuring that the local community needs are being met. And we do that oftentimes through various meetings in the community, working with schools, local partners, all of the folks that we work with. Each county. Probation Department
Mr. Clavins,
response.
I got a question for you. I mean, what you're describing in terms of the work responsibilities of the probation officers reflects a highly skilled professional and demanding job description, which requires a lot of interpersonal skills as well as, you know, a lot of trained information and intervention ability to implement a lot of this stuff, often with a very difficult client base. And for those who aren't directly involved in the criminal justice system on a day-to-day basis, even those who are often don't see a lot of the work that goes on behind the scenes with the correctional officers. So my question comes down to, in order to maintain those skill levels, develop those skill levels, how much of the budget, do you know offhand, goes into training for the employees, if you will?
Mr. Chair, that's a great question, and your point is very valid. That's exactly what we're looking at here. Is the probation officers that we have today are very skilled, and it does require a lot of training, a lot of ongoing training as well. It's not just a matter of training somebody and then just letting that go, but we have what we call booster sessions and ongoing training sessions really throughout the course of each and every year. As far as the cost of training, it certainly can be expensive. We have done a remarkable job in trying to control those costs and contain them by working collaboratively. We have a lot of state trainers that are probation officers actually around the state, and they provide training, but it does become very difficult because a lot of those trainers also have a full-time job of being a probation officer and implementing some of these various programs. As far as putting a number on the actual training dollars, you know, a lot of that, again, is controlled by our county boards. You know, in Carver County, I probably budget close to maybe $6,000 or $7,000 a year for training expenses. Out of a $2 million budget, that's not a lot of extra money that I have left over after we pay salaries and other expenses, juvenile out-of-home placement costs, et cetera. But certainly that's a particular area of resource need for us, is to establish better training and ongoing training for our staff, particularly related to evidence-based practices.
It just seems to me that you guys are the ones that are really on the front line. Once a person's released back into the community, either from state prison or from a county workhouse, you're really the only part of the system that's going to have any kind of ongoing interaction with those folks unless they get into trouble again and specifically end up in contact with the law enforcement officers. So it seems to me that the training and being able to manage that population, if you will, or to use more of a sanitized terminology, is pretty critical. And I know the resources are really tight. But I'd be curious if someone maybe can, if someone knows or can provide to the committee at some other point, more statewide numbers as to what training budgets look like for this. You know, I think I get the need for resources overall and for having enough FTEs and being able to manage the workload that's involved. There's so many different facets to the job of being an effective probation officer that, you know, unlike, you know, some of us who just have kind of a narrower focus, we can focus in on one thing, do it well, and we're fine, but you've got a whole range of things that you've got to be able to do well to be effective overall with your clientele.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it is a very complicated job per se. Just to kind of maybe finish this particular segment, I do want to reference the fact that back in 2011, our evidence-based practices policy team that I continue to chair, we did complete a fairly extensive study of evidence-based practices, which was submitted to the state legislature back in 2011. It's a document that I have a couple of copies with. I didn't hand them out, but it really is a very comprehensive look at what happens when you need to train people in evidence-based practices, and also the benefits. And a lot of this came out of the Pew study report a few years back related to the cost of correctional expenses. And so I'd certainly suggest perhaps as a follow-up that others or the committee members take a look at this report. It is available online at the Department of Corrections website. And again, it's called the Study of Evidence-Based Practices in Minnesota. In that report, we do reference the need for additional resources, as you mentioned, for training and ongoing training for staff and supporting them as we look to develop new programs and implement programs, because it is very difficult work. But it's also very meaningful, and I think really is a wise use of taxpayer dollars. This is where the difference really comes in, and people come through our system, and again, the long-term vision for us is to try to keep them from coming back and living a productive life as a citizen after they go through the correction system. I think with that, I will turn this over to Mr. McMillan to speak a little bit about the reimbursement to our counties. Thank you.
I'll be short, and this is not that exciting, Mr. Chair, the money piece, but we do operate under 50% reimbursement, 244.19 sub 1.6. It's a copy in copy of the piece of the statute in your handout, and it's real simple. I don't want to overcomplicate it. It's simple. There is a formula, and it's based on we should be getting reimbursed up to 50% reimbursement by statute for our professional probation staff in our department. That does not mean we get reimbursed for clerical support, case aids, any of the ancillary parts of our budget. It's strictly for allocation of those probation agents. And our probation agents, that the determination, and back to the partnership and the true partnership of the county board, the state, and the courts, is when we request, looking at local needs and resources, when we request a probation agent, that request is made, first of all, to our courts. Our courts make an approval if they feel there's a need for a staff increase, which then goes to the county board, and then finally to the Department of Corrections for approval. So that's how the system is supposed to work to get our 50% reimbursement. In addition to that, our agencies submit on a biannual basis allocation or request for reimbursement to the state on our actual cost and projected cost for the next 2 years. And so that amount submitted to the commissioner, and then you would hope that it would be put into the DOC budget at 50%, and if it was, we wouldn't be talking about it today. But it's at 30%, and that shift, as you see in the one slide, from 1997 to now, that's where the last 50% reimbursement took place. There's a couple reasons for that, though, I think that are very simple ones. And
sorry,
at least
I'm going to interrupt you. Senator
sure.
Goodman has a question.
Well, thank you, Senator Latz, or Mr. Chair. I'm wondering what looks like what Carver County's done with the funding for CPOs in the last 10 years or whatever. How
sure.
does that look?
Thank you. That's a very good question, and we are going to cover that in just a few minutes. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. McMillan.
Mr. Chair, so we've deduced in our meetings and taken a look at the funding issues that we're specifically dealing with today and not what they should look like tomorrow. That's another discussion. But as it relates today and 50% reimbursement, for us, we've kind of come to the conclusion that really the reason that we're underfunded today versus 1997 is a couple factors we're not taking into consideration. One of them is if in fact, the DOC would have followed over that period of time the recommended reimbursement that agencies submitted for their actual costs for probation officers, which include COLAs, health insurance, and also additional staff, we wouldn't be sitting here today at 30%. So if that in itself for us would simply have fixed the problem, except for now we've dug a pretty deep hole, so it's pretty hard to get 20% back overnight. But that's really what we've come to the conclusion that's really affected us. So if you look at the dollar amount, yes, has increased, but the percentage has gone down, and those are the three factors that really have hit us hard and kind of hit us in the face with why we're sitting at where we are today. And that clearly, if we keep the funding system as it is today, that needs to be clearly addressed with the Department of Corrections and their leadership, with the Office of Budget Management, and the legislature on where we move forward. And I know that's come up before as a possible solution to some of our problems is where do we lobby, who do we work with to get that dollar amount up. I think that slide indicates that. We also wanted to kind of make it a little bit real for you. And we have it in Terrell Arola is here. She's the director in Pine County as well. So the last slide talks about our individual shortfalls in counties. So I'm going to turn it over to John to talk about Carver and Pine and what they've faced with at a real level, at the street level that they deal with every day with their county boards and courts as it relates to the funding.
Mr. Clavins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Just on the last slide does give two examples, Carver County and Pine County. We thought it would be appropriate to bring those to your attention. Based on the chart that you saw with the reductions that we've seen in our reimbursements, over the course of the past 10 years, Carver County has been short about $1.2 million if you account for the 2013 dollars that we receive those. What we've done or had to do really is a couple of factors. One is we've had to seek revenue from other sources. Some of that is driven by offender fees. People are paying additional costs to be involved in the system. Some of that's in Carver County were cuts. We reduced and cut staff positions several years ago. We are currently staffed at around 2006 levels, so about 8 years ago or so, we have about the same number of FTEs that we have today in order to make those ends meet. Our county board has been supportive but also very conservative about additional tax levy money going into the probation corrections system. By example, my current budget's around $2 million. For the probation side of things, we get about $400,000 or so from the state, so roughly about 20% is state-funded. The other 80%, which includes some of our juvenile placement dollars, is really county levy money. So the shift is pretty significant for us. The county board has to put forth a pretty good chunk of money to keep operations going. And again, our funding, as Mr. Milo mentioned earlier in his presentation, we have not added really any staff. We just kind of maintain those levels that we've had for about the last 8 years or so. So
how has your caseload changed?
Caseloads have remained steady. We have to do some shifting with the caseloads, of course. We have had some additional, when the numbers went down in juvenile, what we did is we increased our programming resources, so we moved a position over to help with additional cognitive behavioral programming, trying to provide, again, more evidence-based practices. And our adult numbers haven't really dropped that much over the years. We've got additional pretrial services now that we have that we didn't have a few years ago. So I've got at least one full-time agent who's involved in bail evaluations, conditional release, drug testing, all those kind of things, too. So those resources continue to be very busy with a lot of things to do. So I won't speak for Pine County specifically. Terrell is here from our director partner from Pine County, but her shortfall, according to the chart that I have here, was close to $670,000, and she's been tracking that the difference in the 50% since 1997 on her chart. I know that Pine County has also had staffing reductions over the years, and the board has been very very careful to look at that budget and hasn't offered any extra money that I know of. and the county levy dollars have paid the difference, really. So I assume her numbers may be similar to mine, where it's maybe an 80-20 split as far as state and county funding is concerned.
Right. So you're saying you're at about a 30% shortfall.
Correct. Although, again, our reimbursement is related to positions, as Mr. McMillan clarified earlier, it does not cover clerical staff positions, other specific things, department budgets for equipment and office supplies, all that kind of thing. It's strictly about the positions that we have that are approved, again, through the courts, through the State Department of Corrections, and also through our county boards.
So if you apply your numbers only to those approved positions, what percentage of reimbursement are you at?
It would be around the 30% mark at that point, yep.
All right. Are there any follow-up questions? Did your colleague from Pine County want to say anything in addition?
Terrell?
Please come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. Pine County,
Why don't you go ahead and state your full name for the record as well.
Terrell Arola, and I'm the probation director for Pine County. And I just wanted to, we're a smaller county, but not the smallest county that does county probation services. Our population is almost 30,000. The $670,000 is how much our shortfall has been since we lost our 50% funding in 1997. We did have other resources, the caseload reduction, offender fees that tended to close that gap until 2009, which is what is indicated on your handout. And then since then, the county has been putting in extra dollars. Last year in 2013, that additional cost that they have contributed was $35,000 for last year.
And did the county's supplement holds you steady? $35,000 doesn't sound like a lot, but did it completely fill the gap in 2009?
No. We did do some cuts. We did bring on pretrial, as some of the other counties did, and that impacted our other workload. One of the things that we have tried very hard to do, with as well as the other county probation offices, is implement evidence-based practice. What you can probably attribute the greatest reduction in our adult numbers is the fact that we're doing very little with the low-risk offender, and we're putting our time and energy into the highest-risk offenders and trying to keep caseloads on the high and very low and acceptable. And so where we're finding the pinch is some of those low-risk offenders that still need intervention and our low-risk juveniles, truants, and those kind of offenders.
Thank you. All right, Mr. McMillan.
Mr. Chair and Committee, thank you for allowing us to speak today. We do feel, though, clearly there is a funding crisis in relation to probation in our state, and we want to continue to work with CCA and DOC to see if we can come to some resolve and some positive recommendations for the legislature moving forward, and hopefully we can continue to do that cooperatively. But I think what you've seen today, clearly from all three delivery systems, is there's a problem, and it needs to be fixed and addressed not only short-term but long-term for all of us.
Well, thank you. Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question that's kind of related. How many of the probation officers that you have are nearing retirement age? And is there that's going to cost additional training when they start retiring. So is there a plan in place?
Mr. McMillan.
Senator Dietzick and Mr. Chair, I don't have that number specifically that are approaching retirement. I can tell you what it is in my office. It's three out of 30, but I don't have that specific number unless someone in the audience does.
Maybe someone who knows where, if that number exists, can find it and forward it to the committee, please. Senator Dietzick.
Well, I'm just bringing it up because in a lot of discussions that we've had, I know I used to work at Hennepin County, and so I know a lot of the workforce is getting older, And so there's a question of who is going to replace them, and then that is additional training dollars because you're losing a lot of people with a lot of skills and institutional knowledge. And so I'm just curious is, you know, is it 10% or is it getting close to 50%? And what is that cost going to be then as we look forward?
All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you, all of you, for your testimony.
Thank you.
I will ask, since you guys had an opportunity to kind of fill in the responses, if you want to what the department presented. Does anyone from the department want to make any additional comments in response to the presentations we just heard? Okay, I'm seeing heads shaking. No. Anyone else in the room here wish to make any presentation that would be helpful to the committee as we approach this next budgetary session? Senator Goodwin wishes to.
No, I don't, but I see that corrections manager is here from Anoka County, and I'd like to ask him, since that's one of the big counties in the state, how the situation is there.
Sure.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
It's all right.
Would you go ahead and state your name for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, my name is Dylan Workington, D-Y-L-A-N, last name W-A-R-K-E-N-T-I-N, and I'm the Community Corrections Director in Anoka County.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin, did you want to ask him anything specific? Or?
Well, basically, when you hear the testimony of the other counties, how does Anoka County comparing with the funding issue, the funding, especially I'm interested in the funding from the county, and how I know there's been a lot of decreases in services from the county board, and I'm wondering what it looks like for your department.
Mr. Workington.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Goodwin, our costs, like everybody else's, has continued to climb. The cost of contracted services for a variety of different elements, your analysis testing, costs for employment have continued to climb. We've had budget constraints like every other county has. And since 2003, our department was at 222 employees. In 2003, we are now at 179 employees. So we've had some reductions. Like other counties in this room, we continue the quality assurance elements. So as the CPO directors talked about, we are collaboratively working to increase service delivery capacity by being smarter about how we do that. And those our MACAC group has a quality assurance model that includes those evidence-based practices strategies. And so we continue to pursue those elements. So as far as the county contribution, it's a little bit unique, I would say, in Anoka County, in that we have had to curb the costs by reducing the number of FTE. That's the primary element. And so the percentages vary by year, I'll take 50% reimbursement if you have it. I doubt whether that's there, but CCA counties don't have that statutory fallback some of the other jurisdictions. I will say, from a larger county perspective, we do a full gamut of service. We do ISR supervision. We do supervised release or parole supervision. We do juvenile supervision. We do adult felony supervision, sex offender supervision. We do the pretrial bail evaluations, a complete gamut of court services. We have a very complex delivery system and model. And we have institutional services that are included in our model as well, both for adult and juveniles. We're very proud of the services that we provide, but we would like to do more pretrial services. That's been a problem in our jurisdiction. Our court would like that. We have a very small service delivery model in the pretrial element. And so we have approximately 8,000 people on probation on any given day. We've also cut costs, as Director Clavins talked about, by Director Erla talked about it regarding reduction of services to the lower risk misdemeanor group. And so we've actually cut the numbers, in cooperation with our court, the numbers of offenders that we deal with by about 3,000 annually. saying that we just don't have the service delivery fees, the costs in order to service that population any longer. And so we've taken those resources and moved them to the higher risk populations. And so,
so how have you cut those numbers with the court? Just put some, the judges put them on probation to the court instead of probation to community corrections?
We have, in Anoka County, Senator Latz, we have two ways to do that. One is the court can specify unsupervised probation, which means nobody's watching them. The other way is probation to the court. And so that would be the other model. And so it used to be common practice, and this is probably one of the good things about budget crisis and budget reductions, is that you have to take a look at what you do and cut some things that maybe you shouldn't be doing. So should we be providing probation services to driving after revocation type clients, et cetera? And so, but there are some disorderly conducts. There's some DWI offenders in that group, lower-level offenders that the courts deemed in cooperation with corrections in the county to say, you know what, we just can't afford to provide those services any longer. And so we've cut back on those services.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And another question I have is, you know, and a comment, is that the current county board has turned down state and federal dollars in a number of different programs and have also resisted the wheelage tax. And I've heard that the most recent budget is making pretty significant cuts rather than taking some of the federal and state dollars and the wheelage tax that would have helped keep the county more flush. But my concern is, I just heard yesterday actually that the cuts in the that the most recent budget that the county commissioners are putting together has pretty severe cuts to different departments. And I know we're already lacking in the social service area significantly in Anoka County. So that's a political statement in a way, but it's also a true statement. And I would like to know if the most recent budget that the commissioners have put together has what kind of effect that has had on your department.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, I appreciate the question. Essentially, what's happened in Anoka County regarding the current budget proposal, which is not yet an affirmed budget. And so the exercises that we've gone through in preparing for that is to take a look at some of the cost savings that we've actually done on an annual basis for a number of years. And so as a director of a corrections department, I manage a specific budget, $22 million. And of that $22 million, what am I coming under budget annually, and how do I benefit the county to do that? And so we're given budget targets. And so rather than continue to give me the target that I'm currently underspending on, they've trimmed that target down. And so does that affect service delivery, the current cuts? I don't anticipate it will affect service delivery. It's more of a shift of where dollars that would normally go into a county reserve were shifted from a department to a reserve fund. So there's a percentage that's in that value, but is it a service delivery cut? I wouldn't be able to testify that it is.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Workington.
Thank you.
You know, when I was first elected, I was on the higher ed committee in the House, and we had a budget crisis then. We had a budget crisis almost every year I've been in the legislature. We were funding the Minscu system, and it became apparent that, you know, there was an aspirational number in the Minscu budget formula and statute that said we should be paying, I forget what the percentage was, I think it was 66.67% of the Minscu budget should be paid for by state funds. And it became quite apparent that we hadn't met that budget for a long time. And in my second year in the House, rather than trying to meet the budget, the legislature simply changed the number in the statute and got rid of that aspirational formula. So I'm not suggesting that we do that here, you know, it's been one approach that the legislature has used to address these kind of things. And the other comment I'll make before we close is that, you know, sometimes when you ask to be dumped all into one budgetary line, it makes it easier to cut that overall line than it does if you've got several individual lines in there, too. And I've seen that happen in the legislature as well. So I doubt that would be the case with correctional funding just because of the nature of the budget, but it is something to be concerned about, too, and whether or not that's specifically the direction that we want to go to try to address what's an obvious funding shortfall on the front lines of public safety for the state of Minnesota. So this hearing, I hope, has given us some information to grapple with as we approach the upcoming budget session. I'm hopeful that we will have at least a moderate budget surplus to work with and not have to look at, trimming budgets in individual funding categories. But we'll all be good stewards of the dollars that we have and the extent that we can find a way to work the formula or the process or the budgetary lines to make it more effective to fund the county or the correctional funding system. We'll try to do that. So thank you all for your input. I'm going to let you know in terms of what's coming up. We are going to be having a hearing in December on drones.
December what?
And court fees. Wow.
And on court fees.
12.
Be on December 12th.
11 o'clock.
At 11 o'clock in the morning. We'll have it in one hearing. Drones have been in the media a lot in the last couple of weeks with issues of regulation and so on. And there are a whole lot of interesting issues that surround that issue. Warrants and use by law enforcement, commercial use, privacy issues, causes of action. If someone feels their privacy has been invaded, a whole range of issues. So that should be a very interesting hearing. And also, I want to take a look at court fees in particular, which seem to have been on a never-ending upward trajectory, often simply in lieu of tax increases, a kind of targeted taxes on the participants in the court system. Many of them simply don't have the resources to keep paying increased fees, or they take it out of other priorities that put more stress on them. So I want to take a look at that and see if they're still manageable, or maybe there's some way to look at reducing some fees possibly in the upcoming cycle. So stay tuned. We've got plenty ahead on our Judiciary Committee agenda. Thanks for all of your work and your participation. All right, we are adjourned.
Are we just doing one?
Yeah.